Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about caches, going through a very important issue of what do we do when we want to write to a cache. So we dealt with initially just reading from caches, but sometimes we want to write to memory and our cache needs to handle that somehow. And we talked about sort of two big decisions we have to make when designing a cache that handles the processor wanting to do writes. And one is, what do we do if the processor asks to write some value that is not currently in our cache? And there are kind of two decisions you can make, both of which are made by some real caches. So one is that we can say, okay, you're writing a value, we need to cache it. And the other is you can say, well, we don't need to. We're just not going to deal with that value yet, unless you read it. If you read it, we'll put it in the cache. If you don't read it, we're not going to worry about it. And sort of the big disadvantage of caching it is that this meant we had to fetch the rest of the cache block. Because typically, the processor, if it's asking to write to memory, is not going to ask to write a whole cache block's worth of stuff. It's going to ask to write something smaller than that. So if we want to store it in our cache, we don't have any way of indicating, oh, I only have bytes 4 through 8 of this cache block. We can't do that. All we can say is, here's the cache block. So we would need to read in the rest of the cache block, even the part that was not written to. Then a second question is, when there are writes to the cache that, you know, we actually store in the cache rather than in the slower, bigger memory, do we also need to store it in the slower, bigger memory right away? So the answer, do we need to store it in the slower, bigger memory eventually? That's yes. Otherwise, you might forget about the value. We don't want to forget about the value. But you know, as long as we have it cached, we're not going to forget about the value. And there's not a compelling reason we need to have it right away be reflected everywhere else in those slower memories. And by not putting it there immediately, you know, let's say the value is modified more times, we can save updating that next level as some number of times, you know, only give it the final result, perhaps after like lots of computation on a value that's cached. So there's two possible decisions we can make here. So one is called write through. That's where we say, well, I want to make sure that we don't have to do any bookkeeping about whether the next level's up to date, so we're just going to send it right away. That's called write through. And the alternate strategy of delaying the update to the next level is called write back. And to implement this, we need to do some extra bookkeeping, which is a reason why you might not want to do that. We need to record that it's modified. So later on, when we get rid of that thing from the cache, we know, oh, I need to write this whole thing back. And generally, we'll do this by recording that it's quote unquote dirty with one bit per cache block. So each cache block will be marked as either clean, meaning that if we get rid of it, well, it's already the same thing as it's in the next level, we don't need to do anything, or dirty, meaning that something in it changed versus what we actually read from the next level. So we need to fix the next level before we get rid of it, or else we'll forget about some modification that happened. Then we talked about TLBs. Sort of a translation look-aside buffers, but it's the cache for page table entries. And so our lookup in this cache is we take a virtual page number and turn it into a cached last level page table entry. If we have a cache miss here, what we're going to do that full translation process that you should have implemented for the assignment, the page table assignment, and get the page table entry at the end, just before we're about to add the page offset and deal with the valid bit and all that stuff, and any permission bits, more importantly, and put that in our cache. So next time, we don't have to do that whole page table lookup. So that means on a hit, we'll just skip that entire lookup process. And we learn that the TLBs kind of make our use of virtual memory actually efficient because we can have very, very high hit rates in the TLB. And that means that very, very high hit rates with a very small TLB, which means that we can make it very fast and not have that much effect on how fast every memory access is, even though we have to do this extra cache lookup on every single memory access. So questions about these things we covered last time? Yes?
So for the write back, since the cache contains like the most recent edits, can we read and write to that as much as we want until something else is stored there, and then we do the write back to the next level?
The question is, for write back, can we read and write from the potentially modified version as much as we want, and then later on it's sent to the next level? Yes. So, yeah, we'll make it so that our caches are always the most up-to-date version, so we can just use that for everything until we run out of space in the cache event. Other questions, comments? Okay. So one piece of anonymous feedback. Can I share the annotated slides? Currently, I do not have a good way of doing this. I will longer term work on it, but currently, if I wanted to do this, the best way would be extracting frames of the lecture recordings, which I can actually probably automate reasonably easily. I have timestamps, but that's a longer term thing. I have timestamps for when each slide is shown, so I can actually do that, but that's not going to happen quickly, or I can have an annotation program that actually saves the pictures directly. But currently, it's a little hard for me to do that, sorry. And a logistical note, the cache program's homework that's the homework next week. So it's about sort of C code and cache misses with the simulator. Just want to mention that the assignment's out there and due net a week from Friday. Okay, so our main topic for today, we're going to switch to talking about threads. So we've kind of mentioned threads when we talked about processes, that a thread was this idea of kind of a virtual CPU. And we're going to talk over the next several lectures about writing programs which have one process typically and multiple threads in that process. And one question is, why would we want to do this? And there's kind of two things people are usually trying to do when they have sort of a single multi-threaded program. And we can kind of classify these into what we'll call concurrency and what we'll call parallelism. So concurrency is that we have different things that we want to happen at the same time. So like maybe we have a web server that's serving multiple users, and we kind of are thinking of we're doing different things for each web browser connected to the web server. And a way we might want to program that is by having one thread for each one. That's not the only way of programming, it's a way we might want to do it. Or if we have a web browser, we're displaying several tabs of web pages, we might have a thread to handle the activities for each tab, which are kind of semi-independent, but they're probably still part of the same process because there's some stuff that's shared. Or, you know, if we have like, say, a game or a simulation, we might have one thread that like plays the audio, one thread that handles the keyboard input, like doing different tasks, but often we want them in the same process because they do have a lot of shared data between them. You know, they're not independent programs, really. So that concurrency, so it's doing these different things, but often things that are kind of interact with each other. Parallelism is doing kind of one big task, but we want to do the same thing with more resources. So, you know, if I have a simulation of some sort, well, we could do that simulation with one core, but we really want to use multiple cores at the same time, and threads would be a way of doing that. We want to take advantage of the fact that our processor can run multiple streams of instructions at the same time, and we'll call that parallelism because we're doing something that, you know, is, you know, kind of more naturally done with one thread. Whereas with the concurrency example, like the threads kind of come naturally from the different things we're trying to do. And we're going to have an assignment that's based on sort of the parallelism case as kind of a, you know, doing something, some amount of threaded programming, so you have experience with that. So we're going to talk about having processes with multiple threads. So our typical process so far, we have like some open files, a process ID, like signal handlers. We have its code and its like global variables and its heap and so on. And we have the information for a thread. We have its registers, its program counter, its stack, and some other per-thread information. In a multi-threaded process, we're going to have still just one copy of files and a process ID and signal handlers and code that's loaded and global variables in the heap and so on, but we're going to have multiple threads, meaning we're going to have multiple sets of registers and program counters and stacks, all part of one process that shares all these files, these global variables, and so on. So questions? Yes? So the question, what I mean by files, I mean open files, yes. So I mean open files as in the file descriptors we've seen with dupe2 and the like. Okay, other questions? So we've seen how we would create multiple new whole processes, but how do we create extra threads within our process? And on Linux, the API for that is going to be as part of what's called pthreads. And there's a function called pthreadcreate. And this has a rather different design than fork or exec, given that it's in the same process. And so the way we call pthreadcreate, you see an example here, we have these two calls to pthreadcreate. And if we ran this, we'd end up having, when we got to the dot, 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 three threads running. And if we had three cores, potentially they could all be running at the same time. If we only had one core, then they'd be taking turns, just like if we had three programs running at the same time, they'd take turns on a single core with that time multiplexing idea we talked about early in the semester. So you can see that the way we actually start threads, so this looks very different. So we'll go over this library called pthreadcreate. So pthreadcreate takes, as its first argument, a place to put a thread identifier. So here we're passing a pointer, because when I call pthreadcreate with a pointer to pythread, it's going to fill in pythread with a thread identifier. And a thread identifier is basically like a PID, but for threads. So it's basically a number that's getting filled in. And unlike with fork, this is not going to do the very confusing thing of returning twice. And instead, it's going to run a particular function we specify. And that's what this third argument is. And that function is going to run on a new stack, because we have a new thread with its own stack. And it's going to run with a fresh set of registers, because it has its own set of registers. So on, and that's where the thread is going to start executing. So question.
Does this have like a parent and child process like how fork does, or are all of these like just separate threads?
Question, does it have a parent and child process like how fork does? No. So all the threads in a process are kind of on basically equal stand. There's no specific relationship. We will have to deal with waiting for threads, which we'll talk about later, but that's not going to you're not going to be restricted in which thread you can do it from like you are with fork, where you can only wait for a process you forked. You can wait for one thread from any other thread, as long as it's in the same process. Other questions? Yeah. What arguments are the nulls? We'll get to that's here. So what are the nulls? So the first null is some thread attributes. So this is a place where we can specify extra settings about how the thread should work. We'll see an example of using that later. So this can be for the thing we'll have an example for is that let's say you want the thread to have a different size stack than is the default. That's where you could set that sort of thing. And there's some other settings you can put there instead of just null. And this second null here is the function argument. So you can see that when we pass a function to pthreadcreate, it has to have the prototype that it takes a pointer to void and returns a pointer to void. That is required. You can't choose a different one. Sorry. The idea of this is that you can make a pointer to something, convert it to a pointer to void, and then convert it back to the pointer to something with a cast if you want to pass anything to the thread or anything from the thread. And this second null here is going to become the argument that's passed when the thread is run. And in this case, I'm passing null because presumably I don't actually care what that argument is, but I need to put something there because that's how p3create works. It always passes an argument. This doesn't have a don't pass an argument mode. Yes? The question, the second null tells the thread to only run if that argument goes into the third argument function, I guess. So the question is, what would happen if I change this null? So if I change this null, then, so basically, right now, this call to pthread create, the first thing the thread does is it calls compute pi of null. And if I change null to say, to say x, it would call compute pi of x. That answer your question? Ah, that's why it's not working. Okay. Well, go there. Okay. I muted it this time. Microphone difficulties hopefully resolved. Okay. Other questions about our thread create? Yes.
How does the pthread create function know where the other functions are? Like, is compute pi supposed to be like the address of compute pi?
So the question is, how does it know where the functions are? Is compute pi supposed to be address of compute pi? So it turns out that in C, when you type a function name with nothing around it, that turns into a pointer to that function. We could also have written this as at compute pi, and very confusingly, those are the same thing in C. Yes, this doesn't make sense. Yeah.
So in this case, the fourth argument is null, but since compute pi takes one argument, how does that work?
Since compute I takes one argument, how does it work that the fourth argument is null? The null is what that argument becomes when it runs. So it's as if we type compute pi null at the beginning of the new thread, basically. Yes, back there.
Is the pthread create essentially calling the function that's passed? Is that like what it's doing when you do that?
Question, is it calling the function that's passed? Yes. It's calling the function that's passed in the new thread. Yeah.
What if you want to call a function that takes
more than one argument? You would have to make a function that takes a void star and have it call that function for you. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Could you just explain what the second argument does in a little more detail?
Can I explain what the second argument does in a little more detail? We'll have an example with it later, but basically you can change the second argument to change how the thread is set up. So there's a default way the thread is set up in terms of what settings it has, how much space is allocated, and things like that. The second argument is how you change that if you don't like the defaults. There's one more thing about pthread create that we're going to kind of gloss over for all the pthread functions, but I want to mention exists, is that it has a return value, and it returns whether or not an error occurs. So same kind of interface as POSIX memoline had, returns 0 if it's successful, and some other value if it's not. Why would pthread create not be successful? Probably the most common reason is if you're out of memory. Okay, so we see how pthread create works. Let's look at an example here. So here I have a little program I print about to start the thread. I create a thread that calls print message with an argument of null here. That doesn't matter because we don't use it. And then I print done starting thread. And when I run this, I get in the thread printed about 4% of the time. So apparently 96% of the time, I'm not really running this thread. What's happening? Any ideas? Back there? Your answer is the main thread's finishing before, and that's exactly what's happening. And something, so basically the code that calls main kind of implicitly does xset of main and like argc, argv. Like this is, or I should write xset with an I that has one of those. This is what's, so this is in the standard library. The code that calls your main function calls it, and when it returns, calls xset. And xsets the whole process. So that's what's happening here, is that most of the time, main happens to xset and goes to the code that calls main that actually xsets the whole process. And that happens before the thread gets far enough to print anything out. But 4% of the time, the thread happens to run fast enough, relative to main, that it actually does send something out. So how can we fix this? So probably the best way to fix this is to explicitly wait for the thread to finish. And pthreads has a function for this called pthread_join. So I can call that function here. So pthread_join takes the identifier of the thread. So note here that I'm not passing a pointer to it. I'm just passing the identifier directly because it's not filling it in like pthread_create does. And it also takes a place to put the return value. Here, I don't care about storing the return value, so I say don't put it anywhere. I don't care. And this will fix that problem. So questions? Right here. So if we're thinking about what we did with fork, this is kind of analogous to using wait PID here. And like wait PID, we have a sort of exit status we can get. With wait PID, that was like a number. Here, it's a pointer. There's also, yeah, sorry. Question, given that pthread_create has one argument only that it passes, can I call a function with multiple arguments? Not directly with pthread_create, but you can call a function that calls another function. Yes, back there. What is putting a place to put the return value there? We'll look at an example of that later. But basically, it's a way that we can retrieve this value that is returned from the thread function. Other questions? OK. So there's, as the slide title here hints, there's another way you could fix this that I don't recommend, but I'm going to show to let you understand sort of how the threads work. And that's that I can have my main thread exit as a thread instead of exiting the whole process. Because I mentioned when main returns, that calls exit for the whole process. We could instead just say exit the current thread. And the pthread exit function just exits the current thread, but keeps all the other threads active. So this will happen to work, and even though the main thread has finished, the other threads can still proceed. We still have threads in the process, so the process is still active. Yes?
So for the other threads that just run through a function,
Question, why did I have to call pthread exit and print message here?
Why do I have to call
pthread exit at the end of main to have the main thread exit, but not at the end of print message? So the code that runs main basically runs main and then calls exit. The code that runs print message runs print message and then calls pthread exit because it's the pthread create code. So it's done for us by pthread create. It's not done for us by the code that calls main. The code that calls main instead decides we're going to exit the whole process when it returns. Yes, over there. How does main still return a value? Probably that's unspecified. What the actual, I'm not sure what the exit code of the process is supposed to be in this case. Yeah?
So if there's no parent child specification, how does this keep the other threads going while like returning zero would terminate all the threads?
So question, how does this keep the other threads going? The system needs to track in a process what are all the threads and use that information to know what to do about terminating the process when a single thread exits. So there's something that tracks here are all the threads for a process and knows when I call pthread exit, have I gotten rid of all the threads for a process or not, and does that check. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question, if we exit the main thread, are globals still around? Yes, because remember our picture of what's in our process, right? All this stuff up here, that's not part of any thread, so it's still gonna be around when a thread, even if a thread completely goes away. Yes?
Secondary thread from the process that gets into an infinite loop or something, does Control-C still close it?
Question, if you have pthread exit in your main and there's some other thread running, will Control-C still close it? Control-C still delivers a signal to the process. So it will do whatever action is set up for that signal. And if it's the default action, is to terminate the process, not to terminate a thread.
She'll
terminate the whole process, no matter how many threads are running. Other questions? So, as I said, this is not recommended. You shouldn't do this, but I want to explain how sort of the main thread is not really special. Okay, so we have pthread join and pthread exit. So let's look at an example of using threads, and we're going to look at doing something in the parallelism category, then I'm going to take it, sum up an array using two threads instead of one to do it, with the idea that hypothetically, if this were a much bigger array, that this might be faster than doing it on one thread. With an array of size only 1024, probably not much faster, probably slower. But if we apply this strategy to like a 100 million element array, it would probably be faster. So I'm going to do this with just two threads. And I'm going to have one thread that's going to sum the first half of the array and one that's going to sum the second half. Then I'm going to get their two results and add them together. And to make this as simple as possible, I've decided I'm going to put the values to sum and places for the threads to store those final results in some global variables. We'll fix this later because you might have heard that using global variables is not so great. Also, on the life assignment, we require you not to do it, so we should talk about how not to do it. And also, something you might not like here is I have like two different functions that have a lot of duplicated code. We sure like to fix this, and we'll talk about fixing that later. And having there only be one function, not needing to write one function for each sort of part of the array, which, with just two threads, that kind of is manageable. But if we wanted to say, you know, do this in 16 parts, that this would quickly not be acceptable. So I have two different functions, just the same except for some indices. And we're using sort of this results array to get the values back, and then do sort of the final step of the summation in our function which calls the threads. Our function that calls the threads uses pthreadJoin to wait for the threads to finish, to make sure that the results are filled in before it actually adds them up. If we didn't do that, then the threads could still be summing things up when we are trying to compute the final sum, and we would get the wrong answer. So if we think about what's happening here, we have our value and results array, which are globals. We're going to start two threads, which are each going to have their own new stacks. Those threads are also going to have their own registers and program counter. Their program counters are going to point to the two different functions that's in our code. And their registers are going to point to their individual stacks. And they're going to be able to access values and results because it's just all the threads are using the same memory, just different parts of it. Okay, so questions about our sort of basic scenario using multiple threads. Okay, so as a first step, let's fix the problem here of having all this duplicated code, right? We have these two functions which are basically the same. We really like to have one function that can do either of the two tasks based on some parameter. So let's do that. And here I've done that by made it so I could call that function with pthreadCreate. So I need to do some things which are kind of awkward here, because pthreadCreate only lets me pass a void star. And I really just want to pass like 0 or 1. So what I've done is I've said, well, a void star holds an address. I'm just going to use the address 0 to represent 0 and the address 1 to represent 1. So I'll just convert 0 or 1 to an address and then convert it back in the function. So the only reason I'm using a void star is because pthreadCreate doesn't know how to call any other type of function. So once I get whether it's 0 or 1, I use that 0 or 1 to compute the numbers here for what part of values we access and to compute where in the results array we store the final result. Okay. Some questions? How this works? Yes? Question, can I put the address of I instead of having to do a void star? Okay, so let's think about that. So your proposal is that I put that instead here, I put the address of I, and instead of having this int ID, I'm going to do star of int star of the argument to extract the value from I. So this is something that students very often want to do, and it doesn't work if you do it like this. So you could make it work with some different code, but the sort of most natural thing of just pass the address of I doesn't work. And unfortunately, it doesn't work in a very subtle way, in that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's like our scenario we started with, where like it printed in the thread some percentage of the time, but not always. Here, you're going to get the right result some percentage of the time, but not always. And why that's going to happen has to do with when our sort of sumAll runs versus the rest of the program. So if we have sumAll running, it runs, it calls pthreadCreate, and that creates a new thread that runs sumThread. And at some point, that's going to, read I. But that's going to happen after, potentially after the thread running sumAll has proceeded further. So if the thread running some all is here, we're great. But it won't always be there. So one thing that could happen is that we have this loop run for I equals 0, then for I equals 1, and maybe the time that it reads I will have proceeded to I equals 1. And even though we started it when I equals 0, it's going to read 1, and that would be bad. That means it will have 1 instead of 0, even though we thought we were passing 0. Or we could have a arguably worse situation where we finish the loop. So maybe and it takes it up to down here, and we have sort of I no longer exist, and we're just reading some random memory that doesn't hold a variable anymore. We're reading freed memory. So no, you can't just pass a pointer to I. There are ways you could make this work. So one way we'll see examples of ways we can make this work on the next slide, this strategy work. But the main issue is that if we just pass a pointer to something, we need to think about, is that pointer still going to point to something by the time the thread reads it? And if you're not doing something to ensure that, like, probably not. Yes? Question is the design choice of void star argument because we can freely cast between it. I think the choice is intended for you to cast it to pointers, as we'll see in the next example, to other types of pointers. But it happens that yes, you can get away with storing ints inside of it, but that's, I don't think, why there's a void star there. Other questions? Yeah.
Void star to I, how does the casting between void star and the int work to where you actually get the value?
So the question is, why does the original code work and not have this issue with it going out of scope? So basically what we're doing in the original code without our changing these casts is we're converting 0 to the address 0. And then we're converting that address back to an integer. And we're turning 1 to the address 1 and converting that back to an integer. So we're still passing an address into some thread, but we're not dereferencing that address. We're just using it directly as a number.
So I was going to say, if you're accessing like address 0, that would cause like a segfault.
That would cause, yeah, question, yeah. But if I actually dereferenced with the original code, I would just get a segfault because it's a completely bogus address I'm passing in. Other questions? Okay. So let's look at an example where I get rid of more logic. So something you might not like in this version is that I kind of hard-coded this 512. That seems kind of inconvenient, especially if I wanted to extend this to have more than two threads. So here I have a version where instead of just passing one number, I'm going to pass three numbers. I'm going to pass start, end, and also I'm going to pass a pointer to this so it can store the result next to it. And in my main function, I'm going to declare an array of these structs, and I'm just going to pass a pointer to one of the elements in this array to each of the thread functions. And this is going to let me pass both a start and an end value, and also a place to store the result. So the only global variable I'm still using is this actual values array. So you can see here I have this loop where I fill in the parts of the struct that are being are information passed to the thread, and I pass a pointer to the element of the struct, and then I join the two threads. And then I just take the result that has been filled in by the threads in that struct and use that to compute my final answer. And in the thread, I'm converting my void pointer back to a pointer to the struct and then using things from the struct. through its pointers. And the reason I don't have problems with accessing things that go out of scope is because this array here, it's still around as long as the threads are running, because the threads start here, finish here, the array goes out of scope over here, and each thread has their own array element, so there's no issue with them accessing the wrong value or things being uninitialized when they try to use them. Yes? Question, why can I pass an address here and not the previous one? So the issue with the previous one wasn't passing in an address. The question was, would the address still be meaningful by the time the threads used it? So I've resolved that issue by making sure that this array info that the address points to is around the whole time the threads are running. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So what's going on here is that when we run our two threads, they each have a pointer to part of this info array, which is stored on the stack of the main thread. But because all these threads share the same memory, they can access each other's stack via pointers, right? They're not going to access it by putting, they're not going to put local variables on another thread stack. But if you give them a pointer to it, they can access it. That's what's happening here. And as long as that array stays around long enough for the threads, this is going to work out fine. Yeah?
Since it's seen that the permissions for pages are stored per process and not per thread?
Question, does this mean that permissions per pages are stored per process and not per thread? Yes. So when we have multiple threads in the same process, they will have the exact same page table. So the only reason we say each thread has their own stack is because they have different stack pointers, but there's nothing actually stopping one thread from accessing another thread stack if they knew what the address to access. Other questions? Yeah?
Can one of the thread stacks overflow into the other?
Question, can one of the thread stacks overflow into the other threads? Yes. Usually, to help prevent that, there are some pages of memory that are mapped as not readable and writable at the bottom of the stacks. But that doesn't completely prevent it. It can indeed still happen. Other questions? Okay. So let's fix another thing here. So here, previously I had a global variable being used, and we can just extend what we were doing to prevent that, where here, instead of having values be a global variable, it's an argument to sum all, and it's going to be passed to the threads just as part of the struct. And in this way, our threads don't need to have sort of any information about where things are other than what we pass into them. You know, kind of what we expected from writing a function, you know, that the function shouldn't really care who it's run by, just that it's run with the correct arguments. And it can handle, you know, the summing task no matter what they're saying, where your data is stored. So in this scenario, now the threads are looking at this info array that's still in the main thread stack, and that has a pointer to these values. We have two pointers. Maybe we could have done some work to reduce the number of pointers, but probably not worth it in this case. And that values could be some stack somewhere on the heap, a global variable. We don't really care. We still have this issue that in this scenario, when we're running the threads, the thread that starts all of this work, that sort of manages everything, it has to be active the whole time because we can't do anything else with it because we have to keep this array on the stack around, right? We can't start these threads doing the summing and then come back to it later. We have to actually wait for them right away, because if we just exited this function, we'd end up getting rid of that info array that they're using, and they would access freed memory and nothing. But we can fix that by not storing these values we're passing to the threads on the stack. We could instead put them on the heap. So here I've split the sumAll function into two functions. I have a start function and a finish function. And my start function, I'm just storing in my thread info, I'm storing the thread ID and all the information together. I just allocate an array on the heap, fill that in, and then later on, I can refer to that array and use that not only to make sure that the threads, values are available until they're done, but also to, have the thread IDs available for me to join the threads and wait for them to finish before computing the final result. Questions on this code here? Kind of the picture of what's going on here is that, we start these two threads, they just have pointers to something on the heap, and later on we revisit those things on the heap to actually deal with the threads. So we can kind of use threads in this kind of start things and finish them later from wherever case, rather than just having to have all our code be create and join right away. Yes?
So you mentioned that the reason that you were putting the thread struct in the heap was to prevent having the process end and lose the info, right? So couldn't you also do the waiting thing to make sure you keep that info and you can still have the struct on the stack?
Couldn't I also do the pthread waiting thing to keep the struct on the stack? So I guess the issue is that the threads are accessing the struct as they run. Right, so the threads can't keep running if the struct goes out of scope. Now, if we had some way of having the threads, say, copy the struct to their stack and knowing when that finished, we could absolutely use that mechanism to make sure that things are okay. We haven't talked about a way of figuring out when the threads would have finished that, but we will talk about some of those over the next couple lectures. Other questions? Comments? Okay. So we've talked about how the thread functions work. Let's look at, have an example here. So I have a function here that makes a string. We compute a string and return it. And I want to actually use that return value from pthread join, so let's do that. I'm going to have a pointer for it to return into. I'll pass a pointer to that pointer, so pthread join will fill it in. And this code won't work. So why won't it work? Check with your neighbor. But there's something that will go very wrong when you try to use this code. Okay, someone want to volunteer something that, a reason why this would go poorly, why this code will not work? And up there. Void function returning a string. So it turns. So your complaint is that this is really a care star, and we're returning a void star. So I understand why you think that's a problem. So for example, in C++, that would be a problem. It turns out in C that is not a problem. There is an implicit automatic cast. You might also complain that the pthread join function is trying to store a void star, and we're really giving it a care star. Technically, that could be a problem. In practice, it's not. But you're technically, yes, that is not what we're supposed to do. I'm supposed to pass a void star and then convert the void star back to a care star. But in practice, I don't know any system where that matters, even though it's allowed to under the C standard. Yes, back there. You, yep. So the question is it because the string is on the stack? And yes. And when the function exits, that stack is no longer available. In fact, because we dynamically allocate thread stacks, when the thread finishes, we get rid of their stacks. So the pointer points to a thread stack that has gone away, has been deallocated. So that string that we have a pointer to that's stored in this array here, it no longer exists. And so this is here, or I should say this printf call here. Here, this is accessing the allocate freed memory. So that's probably going to crash. Questions? Yeah.
So you're saying that the value that create string returns is like you lose it when the thread ends its process?
Question, the value that pthread join returns or?
Yeah.
You lose it when the thread, so the value itself is an address. That address is fine. The problem is the address points to this memory location that's like over here that's no longer allocated. Does that answer your question? Yes.
How do you circumvent this?
How would I circumvent this? So one way would be that instead of returning string, I could make a pointer that I malloc and copy the string to there, and then return that pointer. And because I've mallocked it, it's not going to go away when the thread does. Yes?
I know you said it before, but could you reiterate why that memory is 3?
Can I reiterate why that memory is 3? Because it's part of this thread stack, and when we're done with the thread, we don't need the stack anymore, so it goes away. Another reason that you don't need to think about threads for is that it's part of the local variables for the function, and when pthread join is called, we're out of the function, so those local variables no longer exist. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Would that also work the mallocing the extra pointer if you cast it as a void star instead of a char star?
Would mallocing the pointer also work if I cast it as a void star instead of a care star? Yes. Their question, void star and care star, for the most part. C has a special rule that basically a void star will convert to any other type of pointer and back without a cast. This rule does not exist in C++, which is why you'll often see a lot of code that even though it's not necessary in C, cast to and from void star, even though in C that is mostly not necessary. Yes, back there.
In the previous example, we were using void star.
In the previous example, we're using global variables to avoid this issue.
Yeah.
So in the previous example, we used a couple strategies to avoid this issue. So one strategy we used here is that we had the thread store it in a value that was allocated on the heap. Another strategy we used was having them store it in a value that is in a local variable, but one for some all, which still is around by the time we need it. And the first example, we had them storing it in a global variable. So we saw three ways around it, basically. Other questions? Okay. So one thing I'd like to mention about pthread join is we see that pthread join, we can collect return values. And this means that if you don't call pthread join, there's a memory leak, because somewhere the system is storing the return value that you can collect with pthread join, even if that's null. And so if you don't collect that, there's a little memory leak. How can we avoid this? Well, the easiest way is you always call pthread join, even if you don't care about the return value, to make sure that we don't leak memory. Another option is that you can use this detach function to explicitly say, I never am going to join this thread. Don't bother storing the return value for me. I don't care. So how does that detach work? After you create the thread, you can call pthread detach, and that just tells it, I'm not joining this. Just don't keep the return value around. I don't care. You can also arrange to make it so pthread create starts the thread as detached, and that's one of the things you can do with that second argument we always start null for. So that you can set up an attribute that says, please start the thread as detached. And you can see that the second argument is this pthread attrt, which has like special accessor functions. And that's because there's a whole bunch of settings we can set there. So another example is you can set the size of the stack for the thread if you don't like what the default is, if you want to use more or less space than the default, which is probably pretty generous. So in this case, I'm specifying, please run the thread with a 32 kilobyte stack. Okay. Questions? Yes.
Can you go back? So what do you necessarily mean? How do you create a thread like without joining it? Because isn't the pthread create, doesn't that automatically enter the thread?
Question, how do I create a thread without joining it? So by joining it, I mean calling pthread join.
Oh.
So that is exactly what I mean. I don't mean something more implicit. Yes, I mean literally calling pthread join. Yes. Question, can a detached thread still access the same stuff as an undetached thread? Yes. The only difference is what happens after the thread terminates. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And a note, I talked about this earlier. I didn't show error checking, but you should do it. Especially if you think something weird might be going on, you should do it. Okay, so in our last 10, 15 minutes, we'll talk about race conditions. And I'm going to sort of look at kind of the classic race condition with sort of bank accounts, because that's a nice motivating example. But we're going to talk about sort of generally how do we coordinate between threads. And the reason this is a big problem is that the order in which two or more threads run is non-deterministic, that it depends on lots of details about what's going on in the system. And we saw that with our earlier example of this happens 4% of the time, that we have some kind of apparent randomness. It's probably not really randomness. It just depends on tons of other things that are really hard to predict. So it's effectively random. And we're going to call this general category of issues caused by these weird changes in timing race conditions. And we're going to have these synchronization structs that are going to let us avoid those race conditions. So I'm going to have an example application of an ATM machine server And it's going to take commands, presumably from ATM machine somewhere, to withdraw or deposit. And we're going to track some account balances. And we want this to be correct. And one correctness goal we would have is that we should not lose money. Money should not just disappear from our accounting. And so let's say I have my server. Basically, I have this loop where I receive a request and I process it. And let's say I want to take advantage of multiple cores for some reason. So I'm going to run, say, multiple copies, say, one per core. Or maybe more than one per core. Just because, you know, maybe getting the account like involves like getting something from disk and slow. You know, so I want to take advantage of, you know, running multiple threads of this. So we're going to have multiple calls to functions like deposit from different threads at the same time on different cores. So, you know, I've just stirred up a bunch of these loops, and they're going to run this deposit function. And let's look at this deposit function and think about what happens if I call it for the same account. You know, two people have, you know, shared account, they both deposit at the same time. What happens then? And we can have a scenario which is pretty bad. And it isn't intuitive, because if you look at this code here, basically, if we call this for the same account twice, we're doing two plus equals operations. Yes, they're going to happen in different threads, but it seems like, oh, we're doing plus equals, we'll get a total including both of those values. But if we remember how code compiles down for this, we can run into a problem. Because a common way this code might compile is maybe the compiler will take account balance, move it to a register, add the amount to that register, and then move it back to the account balance. That's a very reasonable way to compile that code, especially because we can't have an add instruction that like takes two addresses. And we could have a situation, even on one core, where we're running two copies of this, and we add thread A's amount and store it, and we add thread B's amount to the old balance and store a balance that doesn't include what thread A just did. And effectively here, we've lost the write by thread A because thread B computed its value ignoring that computation and overwrote it. And we've lost track of the money that A deposited. Just haven't accounted for it anywhere because it got overwritten by thread B just running at a similar time and not realizing that there was something else using the account at the same time. And this is even though kind of our C code, it looks like, oh, this is just one operation. Doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't look like that this is something which should be a problem, but the issue is that, like, the way this code is actually run is not that we do each line in each thread separately. We do instructions separately. So we're going to want to think about, generally, what happens when we have multiple threads trying to do things so we can reason about, you know, what is reasonable to, you know, assume happens and what's not. So to start that, let's start with a simple example here. First I should say questions about this scenario before I move on to sort of more toy examples and trying to get some logic. Not seeing any. Okay, so let's look at this example. So let's say I have variables X and Y that are shared between our threads A and B, and I do this. Sorry, thread A is writing 1 to X, thread B is writing 2 to Y. What do we think should happen? In particular, what should the value of X be? So who thinks that 1 is a possible value for X after both of these threads finish? Who thinks anything else is a possible value? Okay, so most people only think 1 is a possible value. I think that is the most reasonable assumption because we usually assume, and pretty reasonably, that if we have two separate variables that writing to 1 doesn't affect the other. And this is something we will assume, even though maybe you can come up with like weird ways of storing variables where this wouldn't be the case. We're going to assume that our compilers don't do that. You don't like try to shove two variables in the same byte. And so we don't have to worry about that. Let's go to a more interesting example. What are the possible values of x here? So I have two threads running at the same time. What do we think the values of x should be? And I'll just take, tell me one possibility, any one possibility for something you think could be a value of x. Right back there. One. Okay. So how did you get one? So if we, that's if thread A runs, and then all the thread B stuff happens later. Okay. Any other possible values? Yeah, back there.
Five.
So A, then B. Okay. And then we have B, then A. Any other possibilities? And there.
Three.
How did we get three? So then we have B, A, B. Okay, I agree. Any others? Okay, so I'm gonna propose, so, okay, seems reasonable. And this is probably kind of the model we have. I'm gonna propose a challenge to that with a sort of simpler example. What are the possibilities here? Can someone give me possibility this case? One, okay. So we have one. How about another possibility? Two, any others? No? So I'm gonna propose, why not three? Yeah, we write the first bit, then the second bit, and maybe they get interleaved, so we write a one to bit 0 and a 1 to bit 1. Why can't we get 3? You know, and similarly, why can't we get 7 in the previous scenario? Like, you know, maybe because when we're changing from 2 to 4 and y, you know, couldn't we read some comp value that's in between the two? You know. And your intuition is probably that, wait a moment, this isn't how processors work. Processors don't read our variables a bit at a time. And you are correct, but we need to be told that, and we need to make some assumptions about how values are accessed to kind of have any hope of reasoning about what happens with multiple threads. So we're gonna assume that some operations are atomic, meaning that they happen kind of all at once. And generally, on most machines, loading and storing kind of naturally sized values, that I'll call words, typically like 64-bit values on our 64-bit machines, is atomic. So we don't have this sort of mixing of bits situation. Now, these loading and storing values is atomic, but things that aren't, but that doesn't mean every instruction is atomic. So some of you looking at our initial race condition say, said, well, the problem here is that in order to do this add, I had to move, then add, then move. And you might say, okay, so we can solve this problem by doing this add, this whole add operation with one add instruction. And on x86, you can do that. There's a single add instruction that will add to a location in memory. But while loading and storing values is atomic on x86, adding to a memory location is not, even though it's one instruction. And this is very non-intuitive, because it would seem like, oh, wait a moment, isn't it the case that the processor likes one instruction than the other? Well, if we have multiple cores, running each instruction can have multiple steps, and those steps, you know, don't happen all at the same time. And this can be visible. So as an example of that, I have a program here where I have this loop here where I add with one instruction to a global variable. I just do it a million times in this loop. And I have some C code here that runs that loop a million times in two separate threads. So we have two threads that each have this loop run a million times, adding to the global variable the value, and then I print out the value. So I ran this a lot of times on my desktop. And here is a histogram of the results of the final value of the value. And in each thread, I ran two threads, each of which incremented the value 1 million times from 0. So the expected value you'd get is 2 million. The value I typically got is around 1 million. And really not intuitively, sometimes I got a value that's less than 1 million. And this is because that add instruction is not executed on the processors as a single step. It's not done all at once. Yes, we load a value or store a value all at once, but the add instruction is kind of divided up into pieces, and those individual pieces happen at different times, kind of like in our original scenario where we had separate instructions, moving the value somewhere to a register, adding to it, moving it back. Like internally, the processor runs lots of instructions in this kind of way. So in order to know, will this instruction happen all at once, you need more information. So the question you might have is, how do we ever write code that coordinates between multiple threads? You know, we have to know what things are atomic. And basically, you need to know the processor designer is going to tell you. And also, we're going to have some higher level tools that we'll talk about over the next several lectures that are going to help us practically write code that deals with multiple threads. Okay. And so next time we'll talk about the main tool there, which is going to be a lock as our first topic.
I can't introduce that.